Welcome to What's Eric Eating, Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. This is a show where we talk about some news from the world of restaurants as well as a couple of meals that we've had. To do that, I'm joined by my co-host this week. He is a co-founder of the Houston Barbecue Festival and a Houston hospitality veteran. Michael Fulmer, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
All right. Before we dive into the news of the week, I do want to acknowledge the passing of Alex Ah Young, the chef owner of Fat Eatery, who died after a bout with cancer. Michael and I are not going to be talking about that today. Instead, the Thursday show will be, I've invited several friends of Chef Alex to come on, and we're going to talk about him for, you know, our usual 30 to 40 minutes. So we're not going to talk about that today because it's going to be the whole show on Thursday. So with that said, Michael, let's move on to the news of the week. I want to start with topic number one. It is the results of the 2024 Culture Map Tastemaker Awards. Let me rattle off the winners very quickly. Restaurant of the Year, Totemo. Chefs of the Year, Luis Mercado and Paolo Giusto from Neo. Bar of the Year, Refuge. Best New Restaurant, Andiron. Pastry Chef of the Year, Vanner and Cook of Cafeteria. Bartender of the Year, Fabio Pontes from Bluedorn. Rising Star Chef of the Year, Lucas McKinney from Josephine's. Neighborhood Restaurant of the Year, Burger Bodega. Wine Program of the Year, March. Best Pop-Up went to Jane Wild, and Best Patio went to Better Luck Tomorrow. Michael, that's a mouthful, I know, but I'll ask you a simple question. How did we do, do you think, in recognizing the best, the most exciting, the most relevant people involved in the food scene right now?
No, it's a great list. There's some great nominees. I think most of these are well chosen. You know, I don't know who the judges are. I'm certainly not a judge, but everybody is a judge, right? Everyone listening. So I'm really happy with the Rising Star Chef, you know, with Lucas McKinney. I mean, there's many great options on that list, but I just think he really just slid into Houston scene and just rose like a meteor with the quality, the breadth and depth of what he's doing with Cajun Creole cooking at a very accessible price, you know. And I continue to go back there month after month. There's always new stuff, but he's got some real standards, and I just think he's fantastic, and I'm really happy to see him win. Pastry Chef, there's always a ton of options there, so you know, it's like take your pick. The things that are happening at Cafeteria are very creative, and so it's great to see them nominated, you know, and then win. You know, how do you define Neighborhood Restaurant of the Year? I don't know what your criteria is. For me, it would be a place that is not just kind of becomes part of the community there, but it also reaches out and embraces the community and something more than just serving them, you know, serving food. And what, you know, Abbas has done at Burger Bodega with all his collaborations, with his continuing to embrace other people, other operations. I mean, he's arguably like the biggest fan of the restaurant community in this town, which, you know, is quite a moniker. And, you know, now that he's got an operation, I think that's really well chosen. Also, particularly, it's a fantastic burger. So that's really solid. Patio of the Year, I think, is probably the weakest thing here on here. Houston, certainly not known for really good, great patios, because anywhere from 6 to 8 months out of the year, they're really not operational. You know, you can't really commodify them as a restaurant. So to devote space to them is problematic, you know, for so much of the year that you can't use it. You know, Backstreet, their patio is fine. I actually think the best patio wasn't even nominated. That's El Poblito on Richmond in the Montrose. It's fantastic. It's like being transported. And that's something for your judges to consider in the coming year.
Well, best patio was our wild card. That's only for this year. And it's one that we did across the entire Culture Map network. So we all sort of team up and agree. You know, last year we did a burger category. So, you know, I proposed that we mix things up a little bit and devote it to a restaurant feature rather than a specific dish or style of cuisine. I think the patio at Better Luck Tomorrow is a lot of fun. I think it's a nice place to eat. And, you know, you can say that our weather makes it challenging, but that does not stop people from eating and drinking outside during all kinds of weather. And we had a terrific group of nominees with really, really fun outdoor spaces. And, you know, I mean, any of them could have won. Better Luck Tomorrow is, you know, how it came out. But, you know, if Cultivare or West Alabama Ice House or Axelrad had won, that all would have been fine with me. You know, I agree with you on most of these. I mean, you know, for Vannerin at Cafeteria to win after being nominated for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years in a row, I was really, really happy for him. You know, we both agree that Totemo is one of the best restaurants in the city. And it does really feel like in 22 or in 23, even they had a moment with the James Beard finalist nomination, the Food and Wine Best New Chef for Emmanuel Chavez, that they could kind of come up a tier. So, delighted for that. You know, Fabio Pontes is someone that I've known, for many, many years across multiple concepts, going back to Hay Merchant, going back to Rosie Cannonball, even a little bit of time with Ricebox. But he's been with Bluedorn almost since the beginning, and he's just really found a home there. And so for him to get that recognition, I was just delighted. And the same thing with March, right? We keep nominating March and in all kinds of categories, restaurant of the year, chef of the year, whatever. You know, hopefully winning wine program is the first of many awards for them, because what they do is so special and it's such a high level. So yeah, that's my analysis of this year's winners. I had a lot of fun at the event. I thought all the restaurants that brought food, everybody did a great job. I was so impressed. Our friends at Balboa Surf Club were frying oysters all throughout the evening. So, you know, frying oysters on site, managing the challenges of all that. I was very impressed by that.
I'm glad to see you guys keeping the best pop-up startup, because I think that's a big part of it. That's become a real part of the Houston identity here. And certainly it's part and parcel. You see it in the barbecue world all the time. That's kind of a standard. But for people who, you know, are trying things out and who are considering going brick and mortar, sometimes it doesn't make sense for them to do that, and they stay in the pop-up mode and they make that work. But, you know, it's an exciting and creative part of the Houston community. You know, there's an ebb and flow to it, to be sure, but I always really enjoy it, and I'm glad to see it recognized.
Well, you know, every year I sort of wonder, is this the last year for the best pop-up? You know, it was such a vibrant movement kind of coming out of the pandemic in 2020 and 2021 when we started doing this. And every year I sort of think, well, maybe it's kind of reached its end. And then, you know, I start talking to people and I sort of look through who I'm following on Instagram and what's going on. And I still continue to find a really dynamic group of nominees. So we'll keep that going for as long as it makes sense to, because I agree with you. It has become such a vital part of the food scene, and it has launched so many people. I mean, you know, June, Totemo, Underground Creamery, even Street to Kitchen in some ways, you know, from that stand at the farmer's market to a James Beard Award. So it's been, yeah, that's been a very dynamic part of the food scene. And I like that, you know, we can do that as part of the Tastemaker Awards, that we can recognize something that's not a restaurant or a bar, but is still contributing to the food scene. And so, yes, thank you. Thank you for saying nice things about that category. Anything else?
No, that pretty much covers it. I mean, you know how I feel about Sweet Pea Bakehouse. That, like,
poor Allie. I mean, she makes, and, yeah.
You know, and I realize, like, so many bakery things came out of the pandemic, but this is what she's doing. I'd love to see her go brick and mortar down in Pearland eventually when that I know that's going to happen, but she's just the quality, the commitment to what her craft is, you know, is just really fantastic. And anytime you see a pop-up, if it's out of Pearland up in the Houston area, I would advise all of you to go, because her product, her, in particular, her croissants are just fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. Sweet Pea Bakehouse just makes absolutely incredible croissants. And if anyone is listening to the show that is not following her, Allie on Instagram, you absolutely should, because the product is definitely worth checking out. All right. I'm going to say that does it for topic number one. Let's move on to topic number two. Just a couple of quick openings, recent openings that I want to note. The first is Late August. This is the new restaurant in the Ion from Chris Williams. This restaurant has been in development, I think, for 3 years. Originally, it was going to be Chris was going to work with Don Burrell, who had been Culture and Uchi and was on Top Chef. He and Don parted ways last year. She's working on some other stuff. So instead, he recruited Sergio Hidalgo to be the executive chef. Sergio worked at Ninfa's and some other places around town. But, you know, Don had this vision of like a Asian, Afro-Asian kind of fusion, or, you know, dishes from the African diaspora, but made with Asian ingredients or Asian techniques. That was right in her wheelhouse. But with Sergio, they're looking in a kind of a more Mexican direction, kind of blending, you know, Black culinary traditions, African diaspora traditions, with Mexican traditions. It's a really interesting looking menu. So Michael, I say all that to say to you, what do you think about late August?
When you say it was 3 years ago, it feels like it was in the late 20th century that they announced, you know, it's like the longest, you know, gestation period for a restaurant announcement to an opening that I can think of, at least in recent memory. And there was such this like powerful, you know, synergy when Don Burrell just kind of shot to start him, you know, making it, you know, to the finals in Top Chef. And suddenly she was everywhere. You know, and everywhere you saw her name, you saw, you know, the August project mentioned, and then suddenly they parted ways. And I, for me, kind of lost a little steam with it. That suddenly misdirected. Of course, I'll still go and check it out. I don't really have much more to say about that until I actually experience the event. I just know that it's been a long time coming, and you know, I guess we'll see what happens when they're actually open and serving people.
Yeah, I mean, they're open for lunch 5 days a week for now. Dinner's coming soon. So, yes, it's very much on my list. Very much a place I want to try soon, just because, I mean, you know, you and I have been to Lucille's in the past. We have a lot of respect for what Chris Williams has achieved there. Rado Market, his kind of casual sandwich shop that he opened last year, is a place I enjoyed quite a bit. So I'll be real curious to see how this place comes together.
I agree. And it's interesting that they're, you know, most places actually will do dinner first and then go to lunch. But like whatever works, I think it's always a good idea to do kind of a slow rollout to let your back of the house and your front of the house staff become acclimated to your systems and what you're doing. So, you know, I think that's smart.
Well, and of course, with the Ion, you know, it's that innovation district. So they have that office population that's there during the week. So that's, I think that explains the motivation to start with lunch, serve your customers in the building, and then add dinner and see who you can kind of draw in from Midtown, Montrose, Third Ward, kind of build from there. And then the other opening I just wanted to note is Bar Bluedorn. This is the third restaurant from Aaron Bluedorn, Victoria Pappas Bluedorn, and Sharif Mboge. It is in the former Jonathan's The Rub space in Memorial. Michael, again, I mean, we've talked about this quite a bit, that, you know, Memorial, Spring Branch are kind of the hot new neighborhoods. You know, we've already seen Wild Oats move from kind of the northern end of the Heights to Spring Branch. We know that there's Baya 313, their first location from pizzeria from Austin, is at near Memorial City Mall. And then in the months to come, we know that we have Haywire, kind of a steakhouse from Dallas, Relish, our favorite neighborhood restaurant in River Oaks, and Credence, a new steakhouse from Levi Good, all kind of coming to that same part of the world pretty soon. So, I don't know. Riff on Bar Bluedorn for me. What are your expectations for Bar Bluedorn?
Man, it's nothing but excitement. I mean, everyone I talk to is really kind of interested, and you know, it's like, what a great pedigree. You know, the Aaron, Sharif, Victoria started Bluedorn. They've really established themselves in the community. You know, Navy Blue has done well, and they've really proven themselves as really sort of top notch, not just back of the house, but their front of the house. The quality of the service there is just, it's outstanding. And, you know, Aaron and Sharif's, their ability to bring the people in from New York, you know, this all happened right at pandemic. Of course, you know, I've lived in Manhattan. It's like, it's about as expensive as it gets in this country, you know, and that they've gotten people to come from, you know, which is in some ways a culinary epicenter, to come to Houston, to to reestablish themselves, but you know, to do it like now, kind of like near at or near the top, is fantastic. And to me, what's exciting about Barb Blue Dornan is seeing Alejandro Pena, you know, somebody who started off really just right, you know, kind of, I wouldn't say at the bottom, but, you know, in the back of the house as part of the team, you know, working Sue and Garmager and learning all of those. And, you know, through her, you know, really determination and her skill set, she's risen to the top here, and now she's got a place. And it's you know, what we're seeing now is Blue Dorn promoting from within. You know, they've become that organic device that, you know, like that they've got that their system where, hey, this is what we do, and they can kind of create that. You know, we you and I have talked about how many restaurants are opening right now and have opened in the last 6 to 8 months. And I'm always like, where are they getting the people to staff these? You know, so many people left the industry in pandemic. And you've got to have great training. You've got to have a great system in there. And this is kind of like, I think this is going to kind of prove that they do have a really strong system. And I think that is a really a well-deserved plaudit. And so I look forward to it.
Yeah. And just to sort of build on the point that you made, when Blue Dorn opened, even when Navy Blue opened, they imported a lot of the talent, right? A lot of the people came from New York, you know, management, sous chefs, chef de cuisine, whatever. And with Bar Blue Dorn, they have this roster. They have these people who've been with them for years. You know, Ali Pena is a native Houstonian. She started, as you said, kind of at the bottom at Blue Dorn, worked her way up through the ranks, got promoted to be the executive sous chef at Navy Blue, did a great job there. And so now she's being given an opportunity to be the executive chef. And it's exciting that you know, this crew from New York that kind of looks back to the East Coast for some of their procedures, some of their hiring, has decided that they've developed enough talent locally that they can do that. So yes, I think the expectations for Bar Blue Dorn are sky high. You know, I think Memorial is very excited to have a restaurant of this quality in their neighborhood. And I expect that it will be very, very busy, at least in the beginning, as people kind of want to check it out.
Yeah. I mean, I think, that area, which is, I mean, it's where the wealthy people live. I know, like Briar Grove, Memorial, Tanglewood, you know, the houses pretty much start in the seven figures there. And I think they're a little underserved in terms of the quality of some of the dining, you know, like they have to go into the Galleria or, you know, into the Montrose Heights area, which is where we see so many of the, you know, new sort of higher end places going. And it's not, you know, sort of a cookie cutter steakhouse. Like they're doing their own Blue Dorn identity to that. And I think we're going to see more places like that opening there. As a matter of fact, we know more places are coming. So I'm excited for him.
Absolutely. All right, Michael, I'm going to say that does it for the news of the week. We'll be right back with our restaurants of the week. Stick around. Michael, for our restaurants of the week, I want to talk to you about two new places. Let's start with Prime 131. This is the Live Fire Steakhouse Sushi Bar from Ben Berg. It is the, I think, fourth Berg restaurant to open in the last 12 months or so, following Benny Chow's, Annabelle Brasserie, and Tavola. So, you know, you are my co-host that goes with me to new steakhouses, which means that we always have something to talk about. So what did you think of our meal at Prime 131?
You know what? I overall enjoyed the experience. One, I think it's a great location for them. Once again, Timbergrove Manor, this is, I guess, the Western Heights area. You know, this is, you know, you can't really call it a transitional neighborhood anymore because you've got the townhomes, you've got the homes. So you've got residents there and there's nothing out there. So that makes real estate prices appealing. But also that whole area, I mean, you get, I guess, what you've got, Rainbow Lodge over there. I don't really know, you know, what else in terms of really more of a more elegant or refined dining experience you can have. And there's plenty of people who will from that area who will visit it. I think it's a beautiful restaurant, stunning. You know, like all new high-end restaurants, it's got the open kitchen, and it's quite the large kitchen. You know, it's quite the size. And we talked about this, how like dishes, the environment. There's this kind of holistic Instagram approach. You know, that every wing, that there's a very strong visual component to the dining experience, you know, dishes being brought out with sparklers, the lighting is such that, you know, the plating, very colorful, very powerful, the, you know, it's very attractive. So is it more style than substance? No, I think we had some really good dishes, some good shareable items. There's also a lot of high end stuff so that you can kind of like, if you want to do the caviar lobster Wagyu experience, you know, it's there for you. I think it's interesting that they added Korean to the experience. I mean, you go to, you know, LA and New York, and it's like everything is Korean. And when I say that, I'm not talking about Korean barbecue. I'm talking about, especially in New York, it's really moved into the high end. You know, Atomic's just got named, you know, the top restaurant, and it's not just the top one. It's ubiquitous there. And it's Korean food is, and there's a sizable Korean population and a lot of people here who enjoy Korean food. And so seeing it integrated more into the mainstream is interesting. We'll see if it works for them. They didn't devote like a huge amount of space. So I think that's like, if it doesn't work, they can just flip that back into the restaurant. But I think that's an interesting dynamic to be sure, adding, you know, sushi to it and sashimi. Also, I mean, it brings your food cost up really high. It means you have to really hire high-end staff, people who are capable of executing this very particular cuisine. So it's a real commitment. One of the things I really enjoyed was the smoked veal bacon. You know, I thought that was outstanding. The dinosaur bone marrow, obviously that's meant as a showstopper. It was fine. I guess we had a porterhouse steak, which is almost my least favorite cut. To me, it's like the worst of the strip, the worst of the filet. But I like the char on it. I know some people at our table thought it was a little bit over, that maybe there was a bit acrid on some of the, like the pepper itself, but I really liked, I like the smokiness of it. I love live fire steaks. Okay. You go to high-end steakhouses, you go to Pappas, you go to Morton's, most of these, they have very expensive double broilers. Okay. And part of the advantage of this is, one, they can handle volume, and two, there's hot spots on those double broilers that will get approaching 2,000 degrees. So you can do all kinds of sear and char on that. Plus, you can do volume. You know, they're expensive, but they're really fantastic. But I love the kiss of live fire, and it really came through on that steak. The sides I thought were good. You know, we had a potato dish that, if memory serves, was somewhere in the range of like $24, $22, $24, the potatoes with a raclette. It was good. It seemed a bit pricey given the portion size. That's just my take on it. The service we had, I was impressed to see people doing French service there. Obviously, that's not going to be for every table, but that the fact that they have staff that's capable of that, that's kind of a lost art, I think I see. And a lot of places sometimes just will tell their staff not to do it. I enjoyed that. So we get back to that big question, you know, would I go back? Yeah, I would go back.
Well, yeah, I mean, you went on a whole soliloquy there.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. It's fine. This is what you do. You know, you mentioned the open kitchen. It's not just an open kitchen, right? Bar Blue Dorn has an open kitchen. A lot of restaurants have an open kitchen. This is, they put the grills in the middle of the dining room, right? Yeah. Everybody has a view of the chefs working these live fire, you know, a Jasper oven, a wood fired grill. I mean, you can even get a little bit of smoke in the, you know, a little bit of smoky smell when you walk in the dining room. It's a kind of another level of, you know, theatricality and presentation. It reminded me a lot of Bizarre Meats, Jose Andres's steakhouse in Las Vegas, where you know, as you walk in from the hostess stand, you walk past the cooks with the meat on the grill, and you smell the meat cooking, and it's like very enticing. And that's kind of a typical kind of Berg hospitality thing, right? They add that that level of theatricality, that level of showmanship to what they do. And then, yeah, I mean, I think we had a lot of good dishes. I didn't think that the porterhouse was acrid in particular. I thought it was nicely cooked. I thought it had a good crust.
I did too.
You know, I think, and then, you know, the one thing you didn't mention is the desserts, which, you know, they recruited Ruchit Harneja from Musafir to be the corporate pastry chef for all the Berg concepts. And this is really the first time he's had a chance to put his spin on a dessert menu. And, you know, the best cheesecake that comes in the cloche with the smoke, this grow your own s'mores with the live coals at the table. You know, those really bright, really tart, acidic sorbets that he's making with the citrus, you know, just, you know, really something for everybody in that selection. And just again, like really eye-catching presentations, really, really thoughtful in how they've put all that together. And just a very impressive place, I think.
You know, you say I didn't mention desserts. Desserts were my favorite part. I thought that's where really style, substance, and creativity really, you know, hit the high mark for me. I really like the Bass cheesecake. It, you know, it doesn't need the whole smoke, the whole presentation. It's fun. It's fun. Why not? Okay. And it was delicious. You know, it had that little bit of a crack on the top. It was luxurious without being heavy. That's one of the attractions of the Bass cheesecake. It's not a heavy dish. But the sorbets blew me away. I mean, you know, we have tart, you know, or citrus style sorbets, you know, throughout different restaurants. And I'm a tart lover, man. You can't make it sour enough for me. And they really pushed the edge on that. The calamansi, the yuzu, the blood orange. I was already pretty full and I couldn't stop eating those sorbets. They were so bright. They were so delicious. They were so refreshing. It was a beautiful dish, the bright colors. It was like a perfect punctuation. I would go so far to say I could see myself, if I was dining in the nearby area, is going there for dessert, you know?
For our next progressive date night draft, you can, that's yeah, candidate for dessert.
I got to do it this time. You know, that big front bar. I mean, one thing Ben does, he really knows how to take care of people. That beautiful PDR when you walk in, I think it takes up to about 14 people. You can really do something really fun and you know, private as well as luxurious. But even just sitting at the bar, I love to dine at the bar. I could see myself going there just for dessert. So a really strong beginning, you know.
And then just the one other thing is, you know, they brought us out this big sushi platter and it had sashimi, it had maki, it had nigiri. And I thought it was all like very well assembled. It was cut well. The rice had a little, you know, you could kind of taste the vinegar in it. You know, the pieces were an appropriate size. I just thought it was, you know, anytime, you know, slot it somewhere in between, like maybe a little better than the sushi offerings at a place like Mastro's, maybe not quite as good as at a dedicated sushi restaurant. But you know, I've had steak and sushi at a place like Rocca al Cuore many times and enjoyed that experience. I do think they pair well together. And I think Prime 131 is kind of at a similar level. It is challenging to execute both things well, but I think they're pulling it off, at least for now.
Yeah, I mean, the uni was a Hokkaido uni, wasn't Santa Barbara, which, I mean, Santa Barbara uni is fine. But they're like, no, let's get the really good stuff. Everything was cut well. You know, the scallop was really fresh. That bodes well. That's hard to train new people to do, to be, you know, sushi trained. So, like I said, they've got good people back there. And it's, you know, Ben Berg really, I mean, he's a really smart operator. And I see bright things for that place.
All right. And then the last, you know, I have to ask you, not just would you go back, but since there's another Live Fire Steakhouse that's coming up on its first anniversary pretty soon here, this month, in fact, Prime 131 or Andiron?
I think I'm more of an Andiron person. I like the more intimate feel of Andiron. I like, you know, I like what Michael Sandbrooks is doing there. it edges out for, you know, and having Michael O'Connor there now as a chef, Andiron edges out for me, but I think Prime 131 is still a good experience.
Yeah, I think they're pretty different. You know, I think I'm being a little bit reductive, and of course that's what we do sometimes, is anticipate the questions that people are going to ask me. But I think Andiron is kind of a more classic steakhouse experience with that live fire, kind of leaning in the luxury, and with that incredible wine list. And Prime 131 is a more theatrical experience, like better for a group maybe, but a lot of fun in its way. And so I think it just kind of depends on, you know, what kind of what your taste is like. But I think they both have something to recommend.
Yeah, I would concur. 131 is definitely set up for, they have the big boost, the PDRs, the long, like the bar is definitely more than something like, oh, this is where you're waiting for your table or to have a drink. It's a viable, you know, dining destination, you know, so they're really using it all. So in that respect, for a group, maybe 131, for a date or maybe just a few people or a four top, I would go to Andiron.
Fair enough. All right. And then one more restaurant to talk about before we get out of here. Pizzana, this is the new pizzeria from Los Angeles. It has quite the celebrity provenance. Candace Nelson, who's one of the founders of Sprinkle Cupcakes, is an owner. Chris O'Donnell, an actor, is one of the other owners. Their chef is from Naples. It has a Bib Gourmand designation from the Michelin Guide. So let me just ask you, Michael, what did you think of our pizza at Pizzana?
So I've been twice now, you know, I tried the classic margarita and then the, you know, I guess with you, we had the Neo one, which I really enjoyed. You know, I know one of their hallmarks is that they're doing sort of a 48-hour fermentation on their dough and it gets a nice chewiness to it. I enjoyed that. I liked the bit of char. They didn't go over the top with the char, but the char was good. So that the middle is still light, you know, it's not overdone. It's not a crispy bottom. It still has a chewiness, but it gives it a firmness, a tensile strength to hold, you know, a small semblance of toppings. And the quality of the cheeses, the marinara were really good. We had one of my favorites actually was the fungi, which is the seasonal mushrooms, which in this case were shiitakes and cremini's. Man, the flavor came out beautifully. Like they were cooked enough. You know, one of the great things about mushrooms is they're very forgiving when you cook them. They were just perfect. The texture, the flavor. I think I had a piece left over when I came home that I had later on, and just reheating it, even just, it was really just a kind of a luscious experience. And most of these pizzas are all priced, you know, this isn't Domino's. This isn't, you know, Pizza Hut. So you're going to pay between $20 to, you know, maybe $30 for a pizza. But I think the important thing there is you get the value for what you're paying. You know, I think the only thing I really didn't like in there, I mean, we had good service. I like the environment. I like that they put some, you know, plants in there, like where they could have put maybe a table or two just to make it look a more comfortable, a warm environment, is that they have these pizza holding stands, these rings that they put on the side of the table. So if you're ordering one, two, say three pizzas, so on a larger table, it's a little bit problematic because really, maybe only one, possibly two people can reach that ring. So that's, you know, as opposed to doing something in the center. So it's a cool little gimmick, but to me, it's more of a gimmick.
Right. It looks cool. And it kind of keeps the pizzas off the middle of the table. So you have more room for shareable plates or drinks or whatever. And maybe it lets them make the tables a little bit smaller. But yeah, it puts the burden on whoever's sitting closest to the pizzas to distribute pizza to everybody else. So that, yeah, I mean, that's a minor quibble, and at a normal two top or a four top, everybody can reach the pizza ring. And so it's not really an issue, but we were at a larger table. And so, you know, our poor friend Megan had to be the pizza distributor. But you know, I will say, I'm impressed by this pizza. I have also been twice, once with you, once on my own. And I like that it's a little more, it's cooked to a slightly higher level of doneness, a little more char than kind of a real traditional Neapolitan. So it's still, I mean, you can't really pick up a whole slice, right? It's still a little bit damp in the middle, but or soft in the middle. But once you kind of cut that tip off and eat that with the knife and fork, it's very easy to pick up and hold. And like you said, the crust has a really nice chew, and you know, it gets that kind of caramelization along the top. I think this is very good. And you know, every bone in my body kind of wants to hate it. You know, it's from California. There's a few of them now. They're in Dallas, celebrity provenance, yada yada. But when the pizza's this good, I mean, it's kind of undeniable. You can't dislike a restaurant when it makes pizza that's this tasty.
Yeah, I hate it when they won't let me hate it, you know? Yeah, I was predisposed for similar reasons. Not to mention my own loyalty to locally based Houston places like Pizarro's, and Third Coast. I know some people express concern to me about like the center being a little bit light, you know, being too floppy, but this is the style of what they're doing, you know? And I hope that they don't change, that they stay true to that. And being that they're now a chain, I think that's probably will happen. And people can come around on it or they can't. This is what they do. And I think so for what they're doing, I think they do a really good job, you know? And, you know, yes, I'll be back as soon as, you know, particularly once the River Oaks Theater reopens and, you know, me, I'm a film goer. I could see myself going there on a regular basis before or afterwards.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, you know, how this exactly is going to fit into my pizza rotation, with Pizarro's, with Romano's, with Home Slice, with Gypsy Poet, with Nono's, with Gold Tooth Tony's, with El Ro, with all of the other options for pizza. You know, I'm not quite sure, but I
First
did
world
enjoy
problems,
it.
Daddy. First
Yeah,
world problems.
right. It's, you know, I could see this. It's more sort of casual and traditional than El Ro, so that makes it maybe a little simpler in some ways. But if I want those more chef driven experience, like on a date, maybe El Ro over Pisana. You know, Coastline Artisan Pizza, they've been getting a lot of press for their Neapolitan. I've been there too. I like what they're doing, but it's only at dinner, so definitely Pisana at lunch. And then there's Magdalena, which Mary and I talked about, or no, Mary and I haven't had a chance to talk about on the show yet, but which we enjoyed very much. And they're kind of doing that traditional Italian thing. Obviously, the owner worked at DeMarco for a long time, so he's very familiar with kind of traditional Italian style pizzas. So there's just a ton of pizza in Houston right now, and trying to figure out where to go and under what occasion, I think is a tricky balancing act, even for people who really love pizza. But at the same time, I mean, that's the fun of it, you know, is that we have all these great choices, and Pisana's right in that mix.
Yeah, I mean it's in my neighborhood, so like I said, I can see, you know, going to the movies there and really enjoying that. It's just yeah, the pizza game has really risen in this town, and we're all better for it.
But I'm bummed. Nice. I like your pizza pun. All right. That seems like a good place to wrap this up. Michael, thank you very much.
Daddy, always a pleasure. Hope to see all of you at the Houston Barbecue Festival on April 14th. You can get those at www.houbbq.com.
Yes. The Houston Barbecue Festival, always a good time. If you are a smoked meat lover, that is your place. 30 restaurants, yes.
34.
Okay. So yeah, get there, get the VIP tickets, go get in line early, enjoy yourself, and then go home and take a nap. That is the plan.
I'll see you there.
All right. Thank you. That's it for today's show. Thank you so much for listening. As I said, we'll have a very special episode on Thursday where some people from the world of Houston food share their memories of Chef Alex Ayala.